People know and let these big mob boss owners of these teams that are deep in bed with the globalists know that you are not helping them destroy the spirit of America and basic human liberty. We're not even fighting to keep America free anymore. We're just fighting to not completely fall into a Soviet-style gulag. Again, I'm Alex Jones reporting for InfoWars.com.
I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Thomas Jefferson. The Alex Jones Show, because there is a war on for your mind.
To you all in America from Gibraltar, one of the last great outposts of the British Empire. And standing in for Alex Jones for the next 2 hours, I'm Christopher Monckton of Brenchley. And with me, my kind host here in Gibraltar, is Charles Scott, a successful businessman who's brought me over here so that I can go face to face for the first time against Al Gore on the question of global warming. Gore is coming here to Gibraltar to tell people that they need to shut down the West for the sake of saving the planet from global warming, introduce every kind of restrictions on your freedom, including allowing the government to tell you even what kind of light bulb you can and can't use. He'll be explaining that extreme weather is getting worse, and this is all because of it's our fault, and it's the West's fault, and we must shut down the West and allow socialism to advance. Well, Charles has brought me here to oppose that point of view, and Alex thought it would be a good idea if I hosted the show from here in Gibraltar so as to give you in the United States and Alex's wider intergalactic audience a chance to join in with us and take part. And I'm very happy to take calls on this guest-hosted segment of the show for the next 2 hours, and you can ring on 1-877-789-ALEX. That's 1-877-789-2539. And if you ring on that number and ask to be patched through to the Christopher Monckton Hour, then you will be on the air quite quickly thereafter. So at any time, if you want to join this worldwide conversation, please feel free. And before I get on to the meat of the program, you can also help InfoWars to do its work all around the world. And it's very important work, upholding the cause of freedom, justice, democracy, and the American way. And you can donate to InfoWars via PayPal or via InfoWarsShop.com, where you can also buy various InfoWars products. You can donate by telephone by 1-888-253-3139. That's 1-888-253-3139. Or you can write to InfoWars, P.O. Box 19549, Austin, Texas, 78760. So those are all the methods by which you can contribute to the cause of freedom by donating to the Alex Jones Show. And now what I'd like to do is begin by turning to Charles Scott, my co-host here today, and my very kind host here in Gibraltar. It was his initiative, that I'm here on the island to debate with Al Gore, who's arriving here, I think, tomorrow. Now, Charles, tell me a little bit about yourself, first of all.
Well, I live in Gibraltar, have done so for several years, and it was really as a way of I suppose moving out of the UK, which I found was not going in the right direction, is as a way of putting it, in that I could see that the freedoms which we know and love were being taken away gradually, and I really was frustrated by that and looking for somewhere where there would be more of an opportunity to be able to go about your business without any encumbrance.
Well, that's a very good introduction to the difference between the Britain of today, which is no longer recognizably a free country, and Gibraltar, which still retains many of the freedoms which Britain was once able to take for granted. So this crown colony, for that it still remains, though it now has an independent and very independent-minded government, is nevertheless a territory where freedom still prevails. And you can feel it here, can't you, Charles, in talking to the Gibraltarian people. The Gibraltarians are a very interesting and very distinct race. They combine Barbary stock with Iberian stock. They have Muslim ancestry. There's a mosque, in fact, on Europa Point, one of the most southerly buildings in the whole of Europe. They have, of course, some English, some Spanish blood. They have some Maltese and other of the islanders, because they were, of course, sailing all over the Mediterranean throughout their history. And these are a distinct ethnic group of great interest sociologically, because of the enormous mixture in their background. And they have, since they have acquired what is almost independence in the fact that they now run so many of their own affairs, they have made Gibraltar boom to an extent that one can scarcely imagine. There's hardly a square inch that doesn't have skyscrapers already on it or about to be built on it. It's a kind of miniature Hong Kong. And I find it very exciting to be here, Charles. I went out on your fancy boat the other day, and we went right round the island to have a look at it. And everywhere it's bustling. Do you get that feeling?
I think that's very important. If you're in a place, even though you might not be actively taking part in any particular industry or commerce, if it feels that it is open to that and that things are happening and going in the right way, then that's contagious, and it's a good feeling to start with. It's something that you can't necessarily put any one thing point on it.
But now, in that case, we're looking at Al Gore coming here, and his is not a message of freedom, is it?
Certainly not. Obviously, that's part of the larger picture. But I think that is definitely the case, and that is what got me quite upset when I heard that he was coming, and it's what put me in contact with you.
Well, just to let the viewers know how this works, I do not do campaigns. What I do is I study the global warming subject. I study it very carefully, as best I can. I'm a reasonably competent mathematician. I know a little bit of climate physics now, because I've sat at the feet of professors on both sides of the debate. I've read their scientific papers. And if people come from anywhere in the world and they say, please, will you come and speak to us and tell us about the true climate science that is now being pushed under the carpet for political reasons by Gore and the likes of others, then I will come. And I came here at Charles Scott's invitation because Al Gore is coming here tomorrow to Gibraltar, as he has been to many other parts of the world, and he may have even come to your own locality. And he comes and he says, we have to spend unimaginably large amounts of money on making global warming go away. Now, he himself and many others like him are making very large profits by a really rather sinister chain of circumstances. What Gore does is he talks up the climate scare by exaggerating over and over again what climate science actually says. And he then says, what we must do is put money into green energy investments. And he has an investment corporation which will take your money off you. And that investment corporation has actually done rather well in the last few years for those who have invested in it, because he is very careful to invest only in those corporations which are involved in the renewable energy industry, which attract very large subsidies from governments, in particular the US government, with which, of course, he has very close links. So what he is doing is talking up the scare, getting people to put money in, and then making sure that because he's talked up the scare, governments put in large amounts of subsidies, because all forms of renewable energy would not be affordable unless they were subsidized. And there's a very good reason for this. And Charles, we might talk a little bit about this now. Extreme weather events have been happening all over the world. This is Gore's main message now, that science is saying, so he says, that extreme weather is caused by us. You have recently had in the United States, for instance, a very unusually hot summer. And that very hot summer has led many people to think that, oh, well, this is all because of global warming. And in fact, opinion polls recently, for the first time in many years, are beginning to show a very slight uptick in the number of people who believe that global warming might be having an appreciable effect on the world's climate. But let's take a few concrete examples to illustrate why it is that Al Gore is wrong on this question. And first of all, let's look at the question of renewable energy as a way of dealing with extreme weather. Now, this is a point which has long worried me. You see vast subsidies being paid. We have one wind farm, for instance, off the coast of Kent, the largest in the world at the moment, which is being given a subsidy of $2 billion, and I do not mean million, I mean billion US dollars, over the next 20 years. And that wind farm would, even if it worked as fully as its inventors had intended, reduce global warming by 0.000006 Celsius. And that it would do that, you wouldn't be able to measure it with any known instrument. So they're going to spend $2 billion on enriching the organization which has set up this wind farm. And this is not going to make any difference to the climate of the planet at all. Now, Alex Jones, as you know, is based in Austin, Texas. And in Texas last year in particular, and to a lesser extent this year, you've had very considerable drought. You've had very hot weather. Well, you are in a subtropical climate, so you would expect to get hot weather a lot of the time. But last year in particular, you had temperatures which were around 7 Fahrenheit degrees warmer than what has been normally observed over the last 100 years in Texas. And of course, you'll get the likes of Al Gore and various others saying, oh, well, this is all because of global warming. Well, no, it can't be, because global warming has only caused 1/10 of that amount of warming over the whole of the last century. And even then, only if you believe that all the warming that's occurred over the last century is attributable to global warming. So this is simply rodomontade. They're simply making it up. They're trying to say that extreme weather is all down to us, when it is known, for instance, that the Texas and Oklahoma heat waves of last year were caused primarily by what is called a blocking high. This is a weather system where very high pressure becomes established, and it becomes so firmly established that the normal flow eastward around the world from the west of the winds is temporarily halted at a particular place, and therefore whatever weather was passing through at the time gets stuck there. And the same blocking highs caused the heat waves in Europe in 2003. They caused the fires and heat waves in Russia a year or two ago, and they did the same. They caused the floods in Pakistan. These blocking highs are naturally occurring events that will happen at various stages in the solar cycle. They tend to cluster together when they do happen. And it is on the basis of that that Gore and various climate activists such as James Hansen of NASA are trying to pretend these are the first signs that man's warming of the planet is causing adverse reactions. And they're saying that the record ice melt in the Arctic this year is another indication of the same problem. But let's take that ice melt in the Arctic and just have a look at it. And the point is there that, yes, we've only been looking at the ice in the Arctic for 30 years. Now, that's simply not long enough to draw any conclusions about the fact that throughout those 30 years, there has been overall a decline in the amount of ice, only in the summer. In the winter, of course, it freezes over much as it always did. But in the summer, for a few weeks, you now get quite a small amount of ice left behind. And there's even a possibility that in the next 20 years or so, there might, for a few weeks each summer, be no ice at all in the Arctic. Is this new? No, it isn't. It may even have happened in the 1920s and 30s, but in those days, we didn't have the satellites to tell us exactly what the coverage was. What we do have is reports from the U.S. Meteorological Service, because they were very active in studying the Arctic at that time. And there's a report from 1922 that says, we have been to the Arctic for 50, 60 years now. We have never seen so little ice as there is in the summer of 1922. And it's quite likely, given that certainly North America and Europe were warmer than the present in the 1920s and 30s, there was less sea ice in the Arctic then than there is now. But we have no way of being able to say for sure. And if we can't say for sure, then we can't say that it's particularly exciting that the loss of ice in the Arctic over the last 20 or 30 years is at all significant, particularly because you have to allow for what is going to happen on the other end of the world. Now, at the other end of the world, down in the Antarctic, there we have had a growth in sea ice throughout the last 30 years. And the sea ice extent there actually reached a record high just about at the same moment when there was a record low over the last 30 years in Arctic sea ice. And so, to a very large extent, the growth in Antarctic sea ice has tended to compensate for the loss of Arctic sea ice. So when you hear people talking only about the Arctic sea ice, as Gore is prone to do, and somehow not getting round to mention that the Antarctic has been cooling and the sea ice there has been growing, then you know that you're not being given the full story. But here's the knockdown argument for why it is that global warming is not causing the extreme weather events that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years. It's a really simple argument. It's one you can try out on your friends and see what happens when you use it. The fact is, there has been no, and I mean no, global warming for 15 or 16 years, according to any of the 5 principal data sets which record the changes in temperatures all around the world, 2 from satellites and 3 from terrestrial stations. All 5 of these data sets show there has been no warming, or at absolute worst, no statistically significant warming for 16 years. Now, none of the UN's climate models predicted this long standstill in the global warming we were told was going to gather pace and get worse. And let's look at what they predicted. They said that in the shape of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this group of rogues and knaves and vagabonds that produces every 5 years a huge report on the climate. These rogues and vagabonds have been saying that they expected temperatures over the next 25 years, since 1990 until 2025, they said we were going to see temperatures going up at a rate of 1 Celsius over that period. By now, we should have had 0.6 Celsius, just over 1 Fahrenheit degree of warming since 1990 when they made this prediction. But it hasn't happened. We've only had less than 0.3 Celsius, about half a Fahrenheit degree. Nothing there to worry about. So when they produce these enormous exaggerations, and they say it's worse than we ever thought it would be, what they're saying is that their own exaggerations are worse than they ever thought they would be, because it isn't happening in the real world. There has been, as I've said, no global warming for 15 or 16 years. Obviously, if you average it out over the last 60 years, since 1950, when at least in theory man could have had some influence on the climate, well, the rate of warming since then is equivalent to just under 2 Fahrenheit degrees per century. Is this a problem? No, it's not. The UN's climate panel has been trying to say, well, it's going to come out at 6 Celsius degrees per century, but so far it's coming out at 2 Celsius degrees per century. So we don't really have the sort of global warming happening that could cause on its own extreme weather events. Now, if the weather is a little fraction warmer now than it was because of man-made influences, then clearly if you get a heat wave, some very small fraction of that, say one-tenth of the Texas and Oklahoma heat wave, might be attributable to us. But to blame all of it on global warming and to do what James Hansen has done in a statement just today at NASA and say, well, we can't think of any other reason why this could be except global warming, why we could have had these heat waves all across America, except global warming. That is a bogus argument for 2 reasons. First of all, the kind of weather we have seen is well within the natural variability of the climate, even if we weren't here at all. This kind of change will happen, and it will happen very frequently. So there's nothing new in what's happening at the moment. But even if there was something new, in what's happening at the moment. As I've said, it can't be caused by us because the global warming they have predicted simply hasn't been happening. Now, what Al Gore tends to do, and he will, I think, try the same technique here in Gibraltar, is to say, Charles, he'll say, well, look, we can point to all these extreme weather events all around the world, and he'll show pictures of floods and droughts and wildfires and ice melting, and it will look very dramatic. And then he'll say, never before have we seen so many extreme weather events. And he's quite right. We haven't. And what is happening here is not that we're getting more extreme weather events, but there are more cameras watching. And now, for the first time, we can see all these events happening, which we couldn't before. And I'm going to give you an example of this, Charles, and ask you to tell me what you think of it. I was testifying in front of Congress a few years ago, the U.S. Congress, in front of the Energy and Commerce Committee. At that time, the Democrats were still in control of Congress, and Joe Barton, a congressman from Texas, a wonderful man, was the Republican ranking minority member, and he had invited me to go to testify next door to Tom Carl, who is a bureaucrat who runs the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which, of course, is completely in the tank for the whole global warming story because it's making a lot of money out of it. And so I said, among other things, there had at that time not only been no global warming for 7 years, there had been cooling, which they had at the time. And he was very angry because he said, no, we wouldn't put it like that. And so the Joe Barton leant forward and said, Mr. Carl, Lord Monckton has produced evidence in the shape of graphs showing that there's been global cooling for the last 7 years. You and your organization have testified before us frequently over the last couple of years on this global warming question. Not once have any of you admitted to us that there is no global warming going on. In fact, at the moment, that there's cooling going on. Would you like to explain why? And he was very angry, but couldn't explain why. At that point, they took a break because they wanted to hear how the Senate was voting on whether to allow a filibuster on the cap and tax bill. So I was actually in Congress at the moment when the Senate voted not to allow filibusters and therefore to require a 60-vote majority in order to get the bill through. And we knew then that the cap and tax bill was defeated. So that means they were allowed a filibuster, I think. But that meant that they couldn't get the bill through the Senate. We knew then. And while they were out watching that, Tom Carl came over to me and said, how dare you say, among other things, that the frequency of landfalling Atlantic hurricanes over the last 100 years shows no trend at all, that it hasn't gone up despite the global warming. How dare you say that? I said, because it's true. And he said, no, it isn't. I said, yes, it is. And he said, I've got the charts here. I said, well, get it out and let's have a look. So he got out the chart. And what it showed was I was actually wrong, because there hadn't been any trend at all in these landfalling Atlantic hurricanes, not for 100 years, but for 150 years. No trend at all. But he then said, this is what I want to ask you about, Charles, whether you think we're being dealt with fairly and honestly and straightly by these people here. He pointed to the chart of the smaller storms, the tropical storms, and he said, but look at these. Look how they've shot up in the last 30 years. He said, what do you think of that? And I said, Mr. Carl, you can try this out on your average congressman or senator, but you can't expect that to work on me. Because now we've got satellites, which we didn't have 30 years ago, so they can see and count every tropical storm. And all you're seeing there is the fact that more and more satellites have gone up over the last 30 years, and so they're reporting more and more storms. It doesn't mean that there are more and more storms. To which, again, he had no answer. Now, would I be right in saying, Charles, that it's for that kind of reason that you brought me here to make sure that this sort of nonsense is no longer peddled to the general public?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's quite clear that this is what's happening. You can abuse figures any way you like, and this is a prime example of it. It's using better technology and coming to a conclusion that you shouldn't be.
That, I think, is fair comment. And
one thing that I think really worries me, Charles, is that when I stand up and say these things, I get shot down by the other side. But they don't shoot me down in argument. It's always a personal attack. And you've almost kind of got embroiled in this yourself. You now know what it's like being on the receiving end of these venomous personal attacks on your reputation, purely because you have made the mistake of inviting me here to Gibraltar. And there was Charles wanting a quiet life, and he ends up inviting me to Gibraltar, and all the media go completely bananas. And so we've had a terrific time. We had a wonderful 10-minute slot on the main Gibraltarian news last night. Very fair coverage, actually. But Charles, now that you've seen the sort of reaction that happens when I pop my head above the parapet, how would you like to be in that kind of firing line?
It's something that I would, I suppose, have expected. It does appear to be, especially if you have heard Lord Monckton speak, it does appear that it is the only immediate response that you can give to the situation, and that is to try and find an angle that might discredit him.
By way of a personal attack,
by a personal attack. Because if nothing else, the information that Lord Monckton gives is backed up, and it can, it's very hard, I would say impossible, to refute scientifically. And therefore, if you are minded to try and discredit the message, you attack the man.
You attack the messenger, yes. Yep. And of course, the attacking the messenger in this way, this is the old friend, the argumentum ad hominem. It's a logical fallacy, the attack against the man and not what he says, that was first codified by Aristotle. In fact, it's a subspecies of a much wider and really very nasty logical fallacy. The ignoratio elenchi was how the medieval schoolmen described it. Ignorance of the process of enquiry by which a debate ought to be conducted. And ignoratio elenchi means that when you find that the going is getting tough and you can't out-argue your opponent, you introduce some kind of a red herring. You try and divert things away from what your opponent is saying onto a completely different and usually irrelevant consideration. And one of the irrelevant considerations that is most often deployed in by people who resort to this fallacious kind of argument, ignoratio elenchi, is they attack the person they're talking to rather than attacking what he is saying. And so whenever you see all over the internet that they're attacking me for daring to question this new superstition that is global warming, that they all believe in so fervently, every time they make that attack a personal attack rather than an attack on the arguments I'm putting forward, then they are condemning themselves. Because everyone who has had a classical training in logic will understand at once that the arguments that they are deploying are irrational. They have no basis in scientific fact. So what I'm going to do, I think, just for the rest of this hour, is over the next 20 minutes, to give you, in a nutshell, why it is that we don't have the problem with global warming that the usual suspects, the IPCC, the Al Gores, the James Hansons of this world, are trying to tell us we have. And also, why it is that even if we had a problem every bit as big as they said it was, it would still be 10 times cheaper to let it happen and adapt to its consequences and pay the cost of adapting to its consequences than it would be simply to try to spend a single red cent now on making global warming go away. So there are two main parts to this argument. One is scientific and the other is economic. And I'll start with the scientific argument. So in the next 20 minutes, you're going to get the complete answer to the global warming scam in one very easy lesson. Now, first of all, why don't we have a problem? And we have to begin by making concessions to the other side. And again, in the medieval canons of argument, you were expected to concede as much as possible of the other side's argument. And this is a procedure still followed in the courts of law today. where increasingly the courts are resorting to saying, well, let's distinguish between those facts that are agreed on both sides, and we agree that before the hearing, and those facts which are not agreed, and it's only those facts we need to argue about at the hearing. So let's start with what we do agree with from the other side. We agree that carbon dioxide and many other gases are greenhouse gases. And this greenhouse is a bad word for it. But what it means is if you put them into the atmosphere in rather larger quantities than they were there before, then you're going to get some warmer weather. There is such a thing as a greenhouse effect. Get over it. There it is. You will get some warming. The question in the climate debate between the serious scientists on both sides is not whether there is a greenhouse effect, because it's a matter of simple experiment to establish that there is. So we know there is a greenhouse effect. The reason why we worry about the greenhouse effect is that it might cause warming. But the debate is about how much warming it will cause. Not about whether it will cause warming, but about how much warming it will cause and how fast the warming will happen. Now, most of you will have felt after this last long hot summer in the United States that this was quite frightening. It was very hot. But just in the last week, you've had 4,000 cold weather records set right across the United States. So merely because you see examples of hot weather or of cold weather, for that matter, suddenly happening here or there, that doesn't tell you how much warming we're going to get long term. That could all be, and probably is, almost entirely natural variability. So what I'm going to do, just in this last 1 minute before we go to a break, is to establish in your minds that the question we're dealing with here is how much warming we are going to cause. And we have a call coming through, in fact. So yes, right. So I've just been told we have a call coming through, and I'd be very, very happy if Mike from Texas would come onto the line now.
Yes, I am here. Thank you for taking my call.
It's a pleasure, Mike.
Yes. First of all, a comment. I've experienced many of the same ad hoc and personal attacks on my character as you have, especially when I referenced or directed people to your wonderful 90-minute discussion at the Minnesota Free Market Institute, which was, to me, beyond the shadow of a doubt, the best set of arguments, both debunking the global warming lie and exposing those who are perpetrating it on us. It was beautiful. Thank you.
That's very kind.
Well, the question is it inappropriate when you go before any council to discuss these issues to ask of the people who are pushing the global warming lie, not only Al Gore, but the rest of his ilk, to display their financial records to prove that they are not invested in these same money-making scams that Al Gore himself is invested in. In other words, show me that you do not have a vested financial interest in pushing this global warming lie, because you're not invested in all of the industries, the green energy projects and what have you.
I think you raise a very, very good question there about the financial motives of those who are promoting this scare. As we said earlier, Al Gore has made something like $100 million, nobody knows for sure, out of this issue. And Mitt Romney made a very interesting comment on this in his first presidential debate against Barack Obama, the one where he beat him into a cocked hat in very fine style. And what Mitt Romney said was, look, you have spent, Mr. Obama, $90 billion on various boondoggles in the renewable energy industry. And then what has happened is that the people who are directors of these various boondoggle corporations have been paying large amounts of the subsidies they've been getting from the taxpayer into the coffers of the Democrats to get you re-elected. Now, you're quite right, because what Al Gore is doing, he's getting them to pay, he's getting private citizens to pay money into energy corporations that are getting exactly these subsidies from that $90 billion of taxpayers' money that's being sprayed around by the Obama administration. And because of the subsidies, while the subsidies last, these companies are very profitable. And so if you invest in them, you make some money. The problem is that as a result of the extraordinary amounts of money being spent by the Obama administration on this and other nonsenses, the money has run out. As Margaret Thatcher used to say, socialism is all very well unless and until the other people's money runs out, which it always does sooner or later. Other people's money has now run out. And so what's going to happen next is what economists call desubsidization. That is where these huge renewable energy companies, into which Al Gore is heavily invested, and so is his investment company, very heavily invested into these things. When the subsidies stop flowing, and sometimes even when they continue to flow, these companies go bust. In Spain, just across the border from Gibraltar, last year, they brought to an end just half of the subsidies to solar energy companies. As a result, overnight, a quarter of those solar energy companies went out of business straight away as the subsidies were taken away. So if you are invested in Gore's investment management company, you will have made a lot of money, but you won't have made it out of renewable energy. You will have made it out of the fact that Gore has got his Democrat friends to subsidize the companies that are on his portfolio. And then, of course, with some of that money, he's paying amounts back to the Democrats to get them re-elected to carry this scam on. Now, if in the private sector you or I, Mike, were to behave like this, then we would be found guilty of fraud and locked up for a very long time. It's a serious financial services fraud. It's known in the British markets as talking up a false prospectus. And that is what Gore is about to do here in Gibraltar. But I issued a warning to him on the main Gibraltar news on television last night that if the talk he gives here is in substance and materially inaccurate, if it exaggerates or invents problems, and if it does so to a sufficiently serious degree, then a report will go to the prosecuting authorities here. Because unlike in America, which is no longer in this respect quite as much of a free country as it should be, in any British jurisdiction, such as Gibraltar, if a politician speaks out in support of financial organizations in which he has a vested interest and does so by telling lies to induce people to invest in them or to induce governments to put money in via taxpayers, then he is committing the criminal offense of financial services fraud under Section 1 of the Fraud Act 2000. And I said to the journalist at my press conference here yesterday that if that happened, I would do that to Al Gore. So, Mike, how do you think of that?
Well, I think it's quite interesting, and I would wonder also, considering the fact that Al Gore's interest in this should have indicated it's purely of a financial nature, I wonder when he starts shorting these investments. And that will be the larger scandal, because since we know he's only interested in this as far as he can fleece the public and line his own pockets,
I'm going to bring Charles on this, because Charles plays the markets quite a bit. Charles, what do you think of that? That's a wonderful suggestion from Mike, that Gore might now realize the game is up and accept that Monckton is right on the science and start shorting these investments before the government pulls out the subsidies.
Well, I mean, again, if you could see the writing was on the wall in that the subsidies were being pulled, and I suppose he would be in a position to get some information about that, then it would be an indicator that perhaps the House of Cards was going to come down.
I mean, the House of Cards is, of course, collapsing really very rapidly about them now. What they can't get over is the fact that there simply hasn't been any global warming for 16 years. Now, don't get me wrong, this doesn't mean that we won't ever have any global warming again. I would expect it to get quite a bit warmer over this century. I think we might see maybe 2 Fahrenheit of warming over this century. That's perfectly possible because of our activities. Does 2 Fahrenheit per century matter? No, of course it doesn't. And likewise, all this business of sea level, which would matter quite a bit in Gibraltar because a lot of it's low-lying, apart from the rock itself. Is sea level going to rise by 20 feet? If it did, it would inundate the very nice house overlooking the water that I'm sitting in now. But I don't find my host terribly worried about that. Charles, are you worried about 20 feet of sea level rise?
I'm certainly not now. I think possibly 4 years ago or so, I think it was in everybody's mind. It was what we were being told, that this was imminent and certainly possible, probably probable. But it's only through research and listening to people such as you that it does appear not to be the case.
Quite right. And in fact, the Envisat satellite, which has just stopped producing data, produced reliable data on sea level by laser altimetry for around 8 years, from 2004 until earlier in 2012. And the way that works is that it sends down a laser signal which bounces off the surface of the ocean and comes back again. And a little computer on the satellite measures how long it takes for the laser signal to get down there and get back again. And, of course, it's only fractions of a second, but it can measure very, very precisely just how long it takes. And it can measure to the nearest fraction of an inch. And then it takes, of course, many measurements all around the world and then does an average. And if you look at the data for the Envisat satellite, just before it finally stopped sending data just earlier this year, then you'll find that sea level was rising. It has been rising. And here is how fast it rose. And I'm going to express this over that 8 years as a rate per century. It rose at a rate equivalent to 1.3 inches per century. It isn't even enough to get my spats wet. It's hardly any sea level rise at all. So Gore's suggestion of 20-foot sea level rise simply isn't right. But now let me get back, if I may. Thank you very much, Mike, for your call. I'm going to get back now to the argument I was giving you here about the reasons why we know global warming isn't going to be as bad as they say. Now, what they say is that if you double the CO2 in the atmosphere, then after about 1,000 years, you will see the equivalent of around 2 Fahrenheit of warming. And, of course, that doesn't sound very terrifying, even though most of that warming would happen in the first couple of 100 years. It still isn't a lot, 2 Fahrenheit over 100 years or 200 years. But then what they do, realizing that that doesn't give them enough of a problem, they multiply that by 3. And they do that, and all the computer models do it much the same way, by pretending that once the planet has warmed up, there are so many instabilities in the way Almighty God created the atmosphere that if we warm it up just a little, it will warm up 3 times as much as the direct warming that started it, because so-called temperature feedbacks will come into play. But it's now been established in a series of papers in the scientific peer-reviewed literature that these feedbacks, far from amplifying the original warming threefold, may actually cut it down by up to half, in which case we simply don't have a global warming problem. Now, here's the thing. Who's right? Are they right to imagine these feedbacks are as big, amplifying the warming as they thought? We don't know. And they're basing their whole case on what is essentially uneducated guesswork. 2/3 of all the warming they imagine is uneducated guesswork. Not a single one of these temperature feedbacks that they talk about can be measured directly. It cannot be established by any theoretical method, how big it is or in which direction even. Nor can you distinguish any individual feedback observationally from any other feedback. Nor can you distinguish it from the original forcing, such as adding CO2 to the atmosphere, that triggered it in the first place. None of these things can be done. And so when you hear Al Gore saying, it is certain that we're doomed, no, it isn't. Because 2/3 of the warming they imagine is simply guesswork, and guesswork which an increasing body of papers in the scientific literature is saying must be wrong. So that's the main reason why we don't have to worry that global warming is going to be definitely as big as they say it is. Have we got a call? Nicholas, you're on the line. Welcome from Sweden.
Thank you very much. Good day, gentlemen. How do you do?
Nicholas, delighted to hear you. Thank you for ringing in to the Alex Jones satellite show out here in sunny Gibraltar.
Oh, thank you very much. It's an honor. I was actually going to ask you how to approach and really how to wake up a person who really buys into this global warming hoax. You know, it's really frustrating to me, at least when I try to do it, because it really is like a religion, like a cult. It's so hard to break through, you know, the propaganda and the lies and the delusions, and it's really frustrating. I mean, how would you, what's your, you know, tips? How would you go about what would you start off with? I mean, it's
the first thing I would do, Nicholas, is you know, if you're in conversation with people about this, if you find that they are treating this as though some kind of superstitious belief, then there's nothing you can do because their mind will be closed to any rational argument. But I think there are a few swift points that you can make to them, which would very much help the case. First of all, you would say, as we've been saying on this show so far, there has been no global warming for 16 years, very nearly. And the models had predicted that over that time, there should have been a quarter of a Celsius degree of warming that simply hasn't happened. So we know that the models have got it wrong. We also know that the models have got it wrong because in 2008, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and they are true believers in this whole global warming superstition, put out a report which included a paper by all of the world's leading climate modelers. These are the people who use computer programs to invent and big up this scare. And the modelers said that at that time there'd been no warming for 10 or 11 years, but that didn't really mean that they got it wrong. But they said if the warming continued to be absent for as long as 15 years, then to a 95% confidence level, in other words, very near certainty, the models would have got it wrong, and there would have been what they call a discrepancy between what they were predicting and what has happened in the real world. Well, hello, Mr. Carl, your organization should now fess up that the models indeed have got it wrong, because not only have we had 15 years without global warming, we've had very nearly 16 years without global warming, and that is so far beyond what your own modelers said could possibly be the case, that on their own arguments, we now know that this has been got wrong. And if you refer them to that State of the Climate report in 2008 and make them go and read this for themselves, then refer them to the Hadley Center or the University of Alabama at Huntsville or the various other methods of measuring global temperature, and you show them there hasn't been any global warming in 15 or 16 years, then it follows without any argument that on their own method of presenting the case, their models that predicted this scare have got it wrong, and therefore the scare is over. So, Nicholas, that, I think, is the main point that I would make. But I would also go further than this. I think there's a wider problem here, Nicholas, and that is this, that the educational standards, particularly of our governing class, and particularly on mathematical and scientific and physical questions such as this, are lower now than perhaps they've been at any time since the Middle Ages. And this gives us, I think, a very, very big problem. Because people in government are simply no longer mentally equipped to resist when people put on white coats and turn up and say, we are the scientists, we are the experts, we are telling you that there is a problem, when in fact it's really very, very clear that there isn't a problem. So, Nicholas, there's a few arguments that you can use, but the main way that we can permanently put this right is by raising the standard of education and perhaps restoring the old classical methods of education whereby people were taught logic. For instance, you often hear people say that you have to believe in global warming because, and you have to do this in baby talk because this is intellectually what it is, they say there's a consensus. Now, this is baby talk, intellectually speaking, because Aristotle, 2,350 years ago, who invented single-handed the science of logic, in two wonderful books, The Prior and Posterior Analytics, which you may like to read, he wrote a book that started him off down thinking about logic, which was called The Refutations of the Sophists. They were the Al Gore of their day. And the Sophists had this notion that they could just talk nonsense and that everybody would simply believe them. And Aristotle found ways of exposing how wrong they were. And one of these things was the logical fallacy of arguing from consensus. Just because you're told a lot of people say they believe a thing is so, doesn't mean that they say they believe it so, still less that they believe it, still less that if they do believe it, they are right. And then, of course, they say, but the consensus is a consensus of experts. Well, X, an unknown quantity, spurt, a drip under pressure. Just because they're said to be experts doesn't mean they are. Even if they are experts, it doesn't mean they're acting in accordance with their reputation. They may be being paid large grants if they say global warming is a problem and get no grants if they don't. Likewise, even if they are experts and even if they are acting in accordance with their reputation and even if their reputation is deserved, they may still be wrong. And so none of the arguments, the main arguments you hear in favor of believing global warming, would have been credited at all by any previous generation in the governing class, because they would have been taught elementary logic, they would have been taught these fallacies, and they would have recognized them a mile off. So I'm afraid we've got to send all our governing class back to school, Nicholas. What do you say to that?
Well, I would have to agree. Very often, you will always see these self-proclaimed experts on television. And that's really frustrating to me, because very often, I mean, what makes them the expert? I mean, it really sends a message to the public that they're the ones who are stupid, you know, that we are intellectually, low. But that's really insulting, I think, you know, just because I, you know, don't have this, you know, degree in environmental science or something doesn't mean that I can't, you know, read the science for myself, as you say.
That's a very good point. I mean, I'm always accused of not being a scientist, and rightly, I have no piece of paper that says I'm a scientist, but I can do math, I can read physics, I can understand the papers that are published in the literature, and I can draw my own conclusions from them, just as you can. Well, thank you very much, Nicholas, for your call. Do we have another call, or are we going to a break? It's a break. Okay. All right, we have another 30 seconds, I'm told. So please hang around, because I am here for the next hour and we'll be very happy to take your calls on 1-877-789-ALEX. That's 1-877-789-2539. So come on, join the conversation. We're having some fun here in Gibraltar. It'd be very nice to have you on the line and to hear what you have to say about whether Al Gore is right or wrong on global warming.
Listening to the once a year Infowars.com Money Bomb special transmission. And because 2012 is an incredibly important year, we're going from a special 24-hour broadcast to 48 hours, jam-packed with special guests, calls, breaking news, reports. If you want to see the full roster of amazing special guests and reports that we're going to be airing, as well as guest host, be sure and visit InfowarsMoneyBomb.com.
The city of Austin hosts no refusal DWI weekends. No refusal meaning that the driver can have their blood drawn even if the suspect refuses the blood draw and or the breath test. Now, while we recognize driving while intoxicated as a very serious offense, is it serious enough to have your rights and privacy violated? Police are doing no refusal DUI weekends where they can draw your blood without your approval. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I don't have any problem with that.
I think that's really unsafe. A lot of people faint when they have their blood drawn, and it doesn't make it any safer for them to be driving.
What are your thoughts on them, you know, being able to acquire a warrant to draw your blood even if you refuse?
I don't know. They shouldn't allow that.
I kind of feel that's a little invasive and kind of, I don't know, the lack of communication between them and the community is kind of stupid.
I think even if I'm completely sober, hadn't had a drink all night, I'd still rather go to jail for the night.
Really?
Yeah.
Why so?
I don't think it's fair.
Do you think they could do anything besides blood draws and breathalyzers to, you know, keep the auto accidents down?
whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes?
To keep us safe and to keep everybody else safe.
I think just installing checkpoints and doing breathalyzers of suspected drunk drivers would be a good way.
To limit the number of DUI accidents, I don't know. I'm not sure what they can do, really. It's up to the people, you know.
I think the streets of Austin are safe as they are.
Even from drunk drivers?
There's no drunk drivers. Everyone drives a cab nowadays, I think. Right? Yes. Right.
Do you think texting is more or less dangerous than drinking and driving?
Maybe equally.
Anything that's going to take their sound judgment, then it's better to ban it.
You've seen people text and drive, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that's more or less dangerous than drinking and driving?
It's probably more dangerous, I would think, you know.
I feel like anyone can be distracted by really anything that they do while driving, and taking texting away is just stupid. I mean, you can be talking and still get into an accident. It's not necessarily about what you're doing. It's about the driver and how responsible they are.
Have you ever texted while you're driving?
Always. I try and do it at red lights.
The National Highway and Safety Administration released that in 2010, 10,000 people died as a result of alcohol-related incidents. Very serious numbers. But if you take a look at textinganddrivingsafety.com's post, they found that texting and driving is 6 times more dangerous than drinking and driving. Also, that texting and driving mirrors the effects of driving after having 4 beers. Once again, we do not in any way encourage you to drink and drive. We are simply pointing out that texting and driving is more dangerous. I'm here with
Commander Jason Dustroff of the Highway Enforcement Unit.
All right, so I want to ask you a few questions about the no-refusal DUI weekends. First of all, how long have you been doing them?
We've been doing them over 3 years in our department.
All right, and how did they get started? Was there any particular reason or need for them?
Chief Acevedo came in and really saw the need that we need to hold more drivers that are out there driving impaired, and especially the ones that are killing and injuring people, accountable.
Now, are there any plans to make these no-refusal weekends permanent or to expand them to other, you know, maybe not holidays, just kind of every weekend? Is there any plans to do anything like that?
I know a lot of cities, like I explained earlier, are moving towards no-refusal 365 days of the year, all the time, 24 hours. That's something we're always going to keep in our bag and look at it individually and say, is it right for Austin?
Is there any type of violation of the Fourth Amendment right to be, you know, secure in your person, in your opinion?
No, not at all. This has been upheld throughout the United States that it's within the constitutional rights for us to take that blood.
Recently, the city of Austin was in the news for, you know, having people infiltrate the Occupy movement last December. Protesters were at the port of Houston, and they say that officers were involved in allowing them, you know, assisting them block the Houston port. Do you have any comment on that?
I don't. I really don't have any information on that.
Right, just one final question, sir. Now, we had a chance to speak to some people on the street just a few minutes ago, and one of the questions we asked them is, when you're driving and you look in your rearview mirror and you see a police officer, do you feel safe or do you feel threatened? We talked about 7 to 8 people, and the majority of them said that they feel threatened. When you see a cop car and you're driving and you see a cop car behind you, you know, do you feel more safe or less safe?
I feel less safe.
I feel fine. I'm just, at that point, worried about if I have, like, a taillight out or something.
I think the police have... They're not like they used to be.
I feel very scared, always. Even when I'm not drinking, even when I'm just going to the store, I feel threatened all the time. So, I don't...
Threatened by who?
Just the cops. I feel like they're going to pull me over for anything.
It all depends, because they like to harass. You know what I mean?
When I see the policeman, I don't have any... No, nothing to hide, so they're my friends now.
Now, to clarify, you're saying you feel unsafe because of the police or just unsafe in general?
Unsafe because of the police.
Do you have any idea of why that may be?
Well, I think most of the time people see those lights behind them, is the first thing they think is, was I speeding? You know, did I not obey the law? What did I do? So typically, you know, that's a normal feeling. But I think once they meet the officer and they're able to go, okay, you know, I was just going a few miles an hour over the speed limit, or my tail light's out or something like that, 99.9% of our citizens are doing nothing wrong other than a minor traffic violation.
Now, over the weekend, over 90 people were arrested for the no-refusal DUI clause. About half of those gave both breath and blood samples, but not all of those were voluntary. Now, we had a chance to speak to a couple officers off the record. They told us that the blood draws are not automatic, and they do need a judge's approval to do them. This is Jakari Jackson reporting for the InfoWars Nightly News.
We're coming for you! of your friends have you told about this historic event? It's the beginning of the end for the New World Order. Donate at InfoWarsMoneyBomb.com.
Rallying patriots worldwide in defense of human liberty. It's Alex Jones.
And as the strains of the martial music of the British mass bands fade away, welcome to Gibraltar and to the Alex Jones Intergalactic Show, hosted by Christopher Monckton of Brenchley, and I'm here with my kind host in Gibraltar, Charles Scott. And we're here with you for the next hour, and we're going to be talking about climate economics very briefly, which is why it is that even if there is as much of a problem with global warming as the usual suspects, such as Al Gore, who will be here in Gibraltar tomorrow, say there is, it still makes no sense whatsoever to try to spend a single red cent now making it go away. We'll be looking more widely, and with Charles's help, at the financial situation worldwide, the growing crisis of government debt, which you have heard Alex Jones, who is one of the very few commentators in the United States, talking about this as regularly as he should, and explaining just how serious this position now is. We're going to look at the connection between all of that and global government. We're going to look at threats to freedom worldwide, and we might also very briefly touch upon Barack Obama's birth certificate. I have some interesting news from Hawaii on that subject to give you a bit later in the program. And we'd be very grateful if you would like to join us at any stage. Please feel free to ring in from wherever you are in the world. The number to ring in on is 1-877-789-ALEX or 1-877-789-2539. And they will put you through to me just as soon as they can. And what we're going to do straight away is take some calls that are already queued up there on the board. Are you ready for it? Jackie in New York, you're with the Alex Jones Show. Good day to you, and how can we help?
Yes, good morning. I have two quick questions for you. The first question is, are there any pending lawsuits against Al Gore and his ilk in regards to fraud and crimes against humanity for this terrible, inhumane hoax? And the second question is, in regards to chemtrails and the correlation between the chemtrails day in and day out, increasing the Earth's surface temperatures, I'm wondering if Al Gore and his ilk are using some of that data to also boost their hopes about global warming. And those are my two questions for today. Thank you.
Okay. Now, the first question then is about pending lawsuits against Al Gore. Well, I don't know whether there are any. I suspect not, because people on the whole are quite frightened of him. He's a fair old bully. And suing Al Gore would take quite a lot of courage, knowing that he's got the very best lawyers. He's got lots and lots and lots of questionably derived money to pay them with. And so I think there are not many people who are willing to take him on in that way. Certainly even I would hesitate to do that. But what I have said, and I've said it very publicly on television here in Gibraltar just last night, is that if he speaks, when he speaks tomorrow, in a manner which appears to me to push well beyond what the science says, well beyond what even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says, so as to talk up falsely a prospectus effectively in his investment management company that specializes in so-called green investments, I have said that I will submit a report to the prosecuting authorities here, because it is really the job of the prosecuting authorities to go after financial services fraud. And that is the territory that Gore would wander into if he were to go too far in peddling an unduly extreme climate message. So I think on that point, you raise a good point, but it's probably better dealt with in the criminal courts than in the civil courts. And only then, if he goes well beyond the itself already exaggerated science of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, as to the second question, I can deal with this very easily in a way that I dealt with it in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago with a man who I was visiting, and he was going on about chemtrails. I said, just call up on your computer pictures of the Battle of Britain seen from below. So he put that into the Google search engine, and up came a dozen pictures on his screen, all of which showed the condensation trails, for that is what they are, they're contrails from the Spitfires. Now, they certainly didn't have the time to be spraying chemicals onto the earth. They were far too busy defending Britain against the Luftwaffe, whose planes were also showing these contrails. Now, what a condensation trail is that in certain atmospheric conditions of relatively high humidity, when a hot engine passes through it, it doesn't matter whether it's a piston engine, a turboprop, or a jet engine, same thing will happen. There will be condensation of the water vapor through which the engine passes, and it will leave a trail of effectively all they are is little clouds. They are completely harmless. They will not do you any harm at all. And because the contrails of those Spitfires look exactly the same as the contrails from modern aircraft today, you can understand that the likelihood that something new is happening now, even if it were to be the case, cannot be deduced merely from the fact that you see condensation trails in the sky. So I don't think there's a problem there, because if there were, then the various atmospheric monitoring stations, which are able to monitor what is in the atmosphere down to the levels of even parts per million, would have detected this, and they haven't. So I think we can say that that is a scare which originally arose, I believe, because somebody spelt contrail incorrectly and it came out as chemtrail, and then this whole scare started. So my advice to you on that one is don't worry about it. So thank you very much for your call. Do we have any more calls there? Paul in Canada, you're on the Alex Jones Intergalactic Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud Hello. And clear.
Great.
Yes, I can hear you.
Excellent. Christopher, I have a statement to make. I'm a professional photographer, and what I've noticed over the last, 6 months, for sure, is that it seems that the elliptical path around the sun that the planet goes on has changed. We seem to be getting our energy at a different angle now. And when the planet has shifted, everything else is going to change along with it.
The problem with that is that it requires very elaborate measurements, which are done by astronomical observatories to determine whether any such effect is visible. And I can assure you that I have had no reports from the observatories that I have contact with of any such major shift in the Earth's elliptical orbit. It is true that over very, very long periods, you will get a slight change. At the moment, the orbit is very nearly circular. Not quite circular, but very nearly so. It can't, for very powerful mathematical reasons first established by the astronomer Johannes Kepler, be precisely circular. And at other times, if you were to wait, say, a few hundred thousand years, then you might find it was much more elliptical, whereby the semi-major axis was even longer as a proportion to the semi-minor axis than we have at the moment, where the two are more or less identical. So no, I don't think that it is physically possible to alter the orbit or obliquity of the Earth in any significant degree without the astronomical observatories noticing, and they haven't. So I think you needn't worry too much about that one. But if you are concerned, then get in touch with your nearest observatory and ask if they've seen anything. I think they'll reassure you that they haven't. Any more calls there? Any more calls for us, or are we all done? Yes, okay, we'll have that. Hello, Jim?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, Jim, I can hear you.
Hello. How you doing, Christopher? Let me tell you, you are my favorite guest on Alex Jones. Every time you're on there, I listen to you. I love your logical, intelligent way of approaching this issue, and I feel so sorry for you when you're having to deal with all the morons in Brazil and South Africa. As an intelligent person, doesn't that just drive you crazy that they're so incredibly stupid that they follow this propaganda that is easily seen through? Now, I'll give an example. I had some college. I went to Cal State Fullerton when I was in the Marine Corps out on the West Coast. And when I'd take my astronomy classes, they'd talk about, this was a few years ago, and I asked this very simple question. And I'd like your opinion on this. It seems to me that all of the periods where they show spikes in the temperature of the Earth, you can look at the increase in those things called solar flares coming out from the sun, and it's almost identical, the increase in the temperature of the Earth compared to these solar flares. So as just a logical, uneducated bumpkin such as myself, wouldn't it seem like that what man does on this planet has little or no influence on a solar flare being ejected out of the sun?
Well, you're quite right. I don't think even Al Gore would try to claim that we can influence the size, direction, magnitude of solar flares. You're quite right. And you do raise, I think, a very interesting point. Whether one can draw precisely that correlation between solar flares and changes in temperature, I would rather doubt that it's exact. I think what we can say is that that is one of the influences on temperature. And, of course, others are the El Niño-La Niña oscillations, which are naturally occurring every 3 or 4 years. We've just had a double-dip La Niña, which tends to make the weather a bit cooler than it would otherwise be. We're heading, I think, next year probably, into an El Niño. It's not easy to predict these. The models certainly can't do it, so I'm not going to claim that I can try. But we should be due for an El Niño soon, and then we will get a bit more global warming when that happens. But these are naturally occurring events. There are also 60-year cycles where for 30 years at a time you get warming followed by 30 years of relatively cooler weather, and those are the cycles of the Great Ocean Oscillations, as they're called. And these natural cycles predominate. And it's clear now, after the 50 or 60 years we've had of putting significant amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere, or global warming pollution, as Al Gore misleadingly puts it, that we are seeing some slow, small influence from CO2. But your general point is right, that the solar flares are perhaps one of many natural phenomena which predominate in causing temperatures to fluctuate. And we are not yet clearly the major cause or the tuning knob of the climate, as Jim Hansen likes to call it. We're still bit part players in influencing the climate. And of course, if you're too young to remember this, but 750 million years ago, there was 30% CO2 in the atmosphere. Today, it's only 0.04%. The planet didn't catch fire then, and it's not going to catch fire now. Finally, I'd like to thank you very much, sir, for your service in the Marine Corps in defense of freedom. We regard America with enormous affection and gratitude, because it has stood shoulder to shoulder with us around the world in upholding the freedoms that all of us and all the listeners to the Alex Jones Show hold so dear. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your service and also for your question. Would you like to come back on anything?
Well, Christopher, let me just say, keep doing what you're doing. You, when I hear the stories of what you have done with these different climate conferences, I stand up and cheer. So keep on doing what you're doing, because you are the voice of all of us who do not have a voice with these crazy people. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, sir, and God bless you. So any more calls, or shall we carry on with the general discussion here? Keith in Ohio. Hello, Keith.
Yes. Lord Monken. Can you hear me?
Good to hear you.
Good to finally meet you. I got three real quick questions. One, are you going to have to parachute into this event? Two, I understand what you're saying about them attacking the messenger, and I wanted to know if you think it's highly irregular every time you intelligently give them the facts that they attack you on your wall, one like Congress did on your title as Lord.
Oh, yes, yes. Did you enjoy my reply to Mr. Inslee on that? We'll talk about that a bit later on. And your third question?
My third question is, do you find it odd that this is looking drastically like another inquisition coming from NOAA, the NOAA? They were involved also in the big ammo buy. They got a portion of that 1.4 billion rounds of ammo that was bought in the last year.
Didn't quite catch that last question, so I'm going to deal with the first two, I think. Now, just remind me again what your first question was.
Oh, are you going to have to parachute into this event?
Aha, that's right, yes. I'd better tell the listeners what that was about. In Durban last year at the climate conference, I had a debate very briefly in one of the sessions with the head of the World Meteorological Organization, who is one of the sponsoring bodies of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, he, of course, therefore, is completely in the tank for this global warming thing. And I said very mildly, he was making a point about temperature, and he was saying, well, you have to go back 30 years, not just 15, to establish the proper temperature trends. And I said, no, that won't do. You have to go back 60 years so as to take a complete cycle of the ocean oscillations into account. And he said, how dare you lecture me on matters of meteorology? And I said, well, sir, it is correct that if you want to avoid distortion and try to get a true picture, you have to look at the 60-year cycle and take that out before whatever is left behind can be attributed to global warming. And he was so angry that he had me banned from the conference for daring to raise this question. You know, I hadn't called him names, I hadn't shouted at him, I had done absolutely nothing wrong. But they banned me from the conference, so I thought, right. So I hired a plane, and I jumped out of it at a height of 10,000 feet, and they've got pictures of me doing it with a huge grin on my face. And I dropped in on South Africa from above. This got into all the local newspapers. And the UN's climate panel was so, and the UN generally, were so humiliated by this that they decided they'd better let me back into the conference rather than have me go on saying how completely undemocratic they are. So I'm hoping I won't have to parachute into Qatar later on this year. I certainly didn't have to parachute into Rio. But what they are now doing, and it's very interesting, this, Keith, is that they are now banning all non-national negotiating delegates who are nevertheless accredited to these conferences. They're banning us from getting into the main conference hall or even into outside it where the where the negotiating national delegates are. I'm a delegate from a non-government organization recognized by the UN, and I get accredited by the UN to attend these conferences each year. But now all of us are excluded from any direct contact with the national negotiating delegates. So already we're beginning to see the dictatorship putting itself in place, no longer even allowing the voices of legitimate dissent to be heard by those who are carrying out the negotiations. There's no longer any pretense at democracy in these proceedings. And so, to that extent, maybe I will have to get a parachute so that I can parachute into the actual hall where these wretches are carrying out these debates on our behalf, allegedly. Now then, you mentioned quite rightly that I am quite a lot of the time under attack from various parties, and there's one of their favourite lines of attack is, ooh, you say you're a member of the House of Lords, and they say you're not. Well, what I'm going to do is to bring Charles in here, and he is going to read out in his best BBC voice the words in the box on that page of my passport.
Yes, Lord Monckton's passport, and it says, the holder is the Right Honourable Christopher Walter Viscount Monckton of Brenchley.
Cue the martial music again, I think. There you are. So the Home Office, which issues these passports, recognises that I am a member of the House of Lords, albeit, and I've never made any pretense otherwise, albeit that I have no right to sit or vote. I'm what's called a hereditary peer. But nevertheless, I am a member of the House of Lords. But what happened? It's quite an interesting story, this. It all began because I was attacked on the ABC radio in Australia when I was doing a speaking tour there last year by a rather malevolent broadcaster who rang me up at 6 a.m. and his opening question was, are you a member of the House of Lords? And my exact reply was, yes, but without the right to sit or vote. And he then went on to other subjects. But he and his friends then got in touch with a mate of theirs who is called the Clerk of the Parliament. He's a senior official of the House of Lords. And they said, could he please put out a statement saying that I'm not a member of the House of Lords? And the Clerk of the Parliament, who's way to the left, duly agreed to do this. It was a flagrant breach of his duty. He should never have done so. And frankly, he really ought to resign for it. But, you know, I have to accept that the left feel very, very strongly about these issues, and they will use these tricks from time to time. So he duly issued a letter, which you can see on the website of the House of Lords, saying Lord Monckton is not a member of the House of Lords, and he is not to go around saying so. Well, sorry, oh, Mr. Clerk of the Parliament, it's a free country, and I can say so if I want. However, when I got back to the UK, I thought that since I'm not an expert in peerage law, I'd better go and check with somebody who was. So I went to see a barrister, and I said to him, look, here is what the clerk says, here is what I said on the air. Who's right? Am I or am I not a member of the House of Lords? He said, I'll get back to you. I'm going to research this very carefully. And he came back several months later with an 11-page opinion, which ends with these words. Therefore, the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley is a member of the House of Lords, albeit, as he has always said, without the right to sit or vote, and he is fully entitled to say so. So that's the kind of attack that they will still keep on bringing up, because they cannot argue against the science, which now establishes that they got the scare wrong. As we were saying earlier, they got the scare wrong, even on their own arguments. They said in 2008 that 15 years without global warming would mean the models were wrong. We've had 15 years without global warming. On their own admission, then, the models are wrong, and they do not like me saying so. So they use these diversionary tactics. And, Keith, I don't allow this to worry me at all. So is there any point you'd like to come back to me on there?
Just one really quick, real brief. You're right on in both cases. With them keeping you out of the meetings, and with them attacking the messenger, it shows they're scared, and it shows that we're on the right track.
Very good point. They are indeed scared, and they've got good reason to be scared. They bet the farm on this. The left internationally decided this was going to be their big issue because it would allow them to introduce those measures of a totalitarian, socialist, or even communist control, or national socialist, call it what you will, this rigid control of every aspect of our lives that was what they wanted to bring in. And they don't like the likes of me standing up and pooping on their little party and saying no. We're not going to allow science to be dictated by the Communist Party line. We're going to do it by the mathematics and the equations and doing the science properly and no longer being told what to believe or not to believe. Whether anybody likes it or not, there are those of us, certainly such as you, Keith, and such as the Alex Jones Show and all their gallant team, and, of course, Charles also here. We believe in freedom. I'm going to ask Charles a bit about this. Charles, thank you, Keith, for your call. Charles, well, freedom, what does it matter to you?
Well, it's fundamental before you can do anything else, as far as I'm concerned. It gives you peace of mind in that you are not, haven't got an overriding authority pushing down on you for their own possible agenda and to push you into a box where you certainly would not want to be.
And that's the important thing. Being pushed into a box is what the left like to do. They don't believe in freedom. They believe only in whatever the party line is. And, they've excitingly rebranded the party line as the consensus.
Yep.
And whatever the Communist Party line is, now we're told it's a consensus. And it's a scientific consensus. It's a consensus of experts. It's a consensus of evidence. Consensus, consensus, consensus,
so
consensus.
So you cannot possibly object to it.
That's right. And, of course, the fact is that the consensus got it wrong. But by their own arguments, it got it wrong.
But this is the problem, because in my view, it's not about that. They're using this as an agenda to further their agenda. It happens to be the environment because it has worked. But people like Lord Monckton are putting a big spanner in it, and that's a problem.
And now what we're going to do is to move on exactly to that agenda and some of the aspects of it, which you will have heard Alex Jones mentioning before. And in particular, I think we want to move on to the financial situation, because, Charles, you know a lot more about finance than I do. I'm a child in these matters, but you are much more experienced. But it does seem to me that the United States, which is now $17 trillion in debt, having been $10 trillion in debt at the time when Obama took office.
Yep.
Britain, which is now borrowing more per month as a percentage of its gross domestic product than Greece. You have all the various, Greece and other European nations, borrowing far more than they can ever hope to repay.
Yep.
And what I worry about here is that if we allow them to go on running up and accumulating these debts, there's going to come a moment when the kimchi will interface with the rotatory convector, and there's going to be some serious problems. Or am I wrong here?
No, you're bang on. I would say that while 17 trillion is the headline rate, and that's the one that's you hit on your debt ceiling in the US, and it's periodically increasingly often put up. I think that's coming up in the next 6 weeks or so. It'll have to go up again. That is very much the headline rate. The real rate or amount of debt is in excess of 100 trillion when you include all the unfunded liabilities.
Very good. Now, we're talking here of contingent liabilities. These are obligations that the state has taken on.
Yes.
But have not yet crystallized in the language of
if you were to do it by GAAP accounting rules, by normal business practices, you have to account for that. It is only governments that can avoid accounting and hiding the true indebtedness they are in. But under any normal
accounting rules,
you would be somewhere between 100 and 200 trillion in the US.
And so what we're really saying then is that virtually whatever is done at the moment, the debt, the actual debt, when all this contingent liability starts to crystallize, and this happens when people who are promised pensions grow old and start to collect them, for instance, that's an example of a contingent liability
and that's
crystallizing.
That's a massive one.
Then it's a huge one. It's one of the biggest ones. Then there's one of two things is going to happen, isn't it? Either various nations are going to be declaring bankruptcy, or these liabilities are going to have to be repudiated. They're going to have to say to their pensioners, no, you can't collect your pension. We can't afford to pay it. We'll pay you sort of 30 cents on the dollar or something.
Well, there's the honest repudiation and there's the dishonest. The honest is literally that. I'm sorry, you thought you were going to get this, X. You'll get X divided by 10. And obviously, that is hard to do. It is the most honest way, but it is not the way that is likely to go. Basically, you will get your money that you have been promised and that you expected, but it won't buy you anything.
Because we will have inflated it out of existence.
The currency will be inflated.
Yeah.
So you might get $100, $200, $500.
But it won't buy you more than $100 buys you now.
It will buy you a cup of tea, potentially, as we say in England.
In fact, let me see if I can find in my pocket. I have here what happens when you get real inflation. We're going to describe just what inflation is. Supposing your economy consists of five beans, and supposing the economy is represented, these five beans are represented by $5, then I'd be right in saying that how many beans make five? Five beans, $5. Each bean is $1.
Well,
that's your economy. Okay.
Right.
Now, if I come along and print another $5, then that you've still got only five beans. I haven't grown any more beans. Then we're going to have $10, five beans. Each bean has then gone up in price by 100% to $2.
Exactly.
So it means if I've only got $1, I could buy a bean before. Now I can only buy half a bean.
Yes.
That's bad news, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's actually theft if it is the government.
Wonderful. It is, of course, daylight robbery. And I'm going to show you just how far this can go if you do not stop it. Here is, I don't know whether the camera can see this. We've just got to hold it up and hope that you can get it. This is a banknote from Zimbabwe. And you will see the denomination there is, I think it's $100 trillion.
Yeah.
And that is what happens when you have rampant inflation. So what have they done? They now no longer use their own currency because it's worthless. What they do instead is they use U.S. dollars. And what's going to happen to U.S. dollars the way things are going?
Well, I mean, this is the problem. Individual currencies around the world, it's not uncommon for them to hyperinflate into valueless, into being worthless.
Now, let me explain hyperinflation to you. This is something which has an official economic definition. That is, if the currency loses more than 20% of its value in 1 year. However, what tends to happen if you even start to get into that territory is that matters get very much worse very, very suddenly indeed.
Yes.
And suddenly you thought you were jogging along at 10 or 20% inflation, and suddenly you've got thousands of percentage points of inflation. This has happened all over the world. It happened in the Argentina of Perón. It happened in Edward II's reign in England. It's happened all over the place. It's happened most recently in Zimbabwe. The danger now is that economies that once ran themselves responsibly such as America, such as Britain, such as most of the European countries, all of them are now running their economies irresponsibly. And there is a real and acute danger of a complete financial collapse. The left, of course, will blame it on the banks. They'll blame it on the businesses. They'll blame it on capitalism. They'll say that socialism would have prevented this from happening. Well, no, it's socialism that's largely causing it to happen. So I think you'd be agreeing then, Charles, that we do face a quite extraordinarily difficult time at the moment. I mean, how would you feel if you were a nation that owed a lot of money to China? Would you feel that you were still a sovereign nation?
There's two ways of looking at it. You could say it's China's problem. Because China owes the money, you know, China is owed the money. Are they going to get it? You know, it's our money, your problem. And so there is that way of looking at it. But on, I would be extremely nervous if I was China holding many trillions in U.S. debt, and I would be trying to do something about it in order to get value out of the money while it still has value. Because there will be a time where it's losing value all the time, but that might get quite dramatic, and then your savings country savings,
yes,
cannot be exchanged for something in value, and then you have a real problem. But it goes further than that, because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. It is the numeraire
yes,
of
that means currency. The unit of account.
Yeah,
yes.
For the other currencies, they move about it, but basically the dollar is the reserve currency, and it will be the first time in history that there will really be no other currency to run to should and when this happens.
Well, my advice to those who are beginning to foresee this situation is get into Canadian dollars, because Canada has kept a very hard-headed, sensible management of its economy. It has not had the banking crisis the rest of us have had, because it regulates its banks lightly but effectively. It has not vastly overspent on its public debt. And so Canada is looking like an increasingly safe bet, certainly compared with the dollar or the Mickey Mouse euro or the pound, all of which are looking, as we would say in Scotland, peely-wally at the moment.
Definitely.
So we thought we'd give you a little rundown there on the growing crisis. I'll tell you what Margaret Thatcher did about it when she took office in 1979. And at that time, we had had a Labour government, and like all socialist governments there have ever been in Britain, when it left office, it left the country bankrupt. And so she called in her chief economic advisor, a wonderful man called Sir Alan Walton, who'd come across from the States. And she said to him, "Alan, what do I do?" And he said, "You're going to have to put up taxes." And she said, "But Alan, I was brought into office to cut taxes. I'm not about putting up taxes." He said, "Look, Margaret, it's very simple. If you don't put up taxes, then you will not have any economic freedom of maneuver. The money will run out. The country will go bust. You'll be flung from office. And I don't see that as being helpful to the country, and certainly not at all helpful to you. So my advice is, it's only a temporary measure, but you must do it just to get things back under control." So she didn't agree on the spot. And he left and went back to his wife, Paddy, and said, "Look, Paddy, we're going to have to go back to Washington," where he'd come from. He said, "There's no point in our staying here. She's not listening." And just as he was saying that, the phone rang, and it was Tim Lancaster, who was then one of her private secretaries. And he said, "You may like to know that Margaret Thatcher has just called in her finance minister, Geoffrey Howe, and has told him that he's got to cut taxes." And Geoffrey's response was, "I'm not going to do that." So Margaret, in her very blunt fashion, says, "You either bring me your proposals, Geoffrey, or I want your job, and I'll give it to somebody else." So he cut the taxes. Rather, he put up the taxes,
yes,
initially.
Yes, yes.
And then they managed by rebalancing the economy very quickly by spending less, no more grand projects, just everything tightened down very carefully and sensibly. They managed to bring it back under control, whereupon, in a couple of years after that, she was able to reduce taxes again. And one of the first things she did once she had raised the taxes was to use the extra money to pay off all debt to foreign governments. And her reason for doing this was, she said, "I don't want Britain to be anything other than a sovereign nation. and you can't be a sovereign nation if you owe lots of money to other nations. You have to pay them back first. If you have to borrow money at all, and she was not in favor of governments borrowing money, then you should borrow only from your own people. You should not borrow from foreign governments. And look at both Britain and America now. They have had borrowing from, they've been borrowing enormously from China. Now, China is not a Western country. It is not a democracy. It doesn't believe in freedom and capitalism. It is totally against everything that we stand for. And it is now increasingly able, in secret, to dictate terms to President Obama and to Mr. Cameron. And we aren't even allowed to question whatever it is they may be saying to him in condition for continuing to buy up our government debt.
I think they are, but also the fallback position for this, once China makes it clear that they are not going to buy anymore and indeed start selling it,
yeah,
is that the central bank in the given country, in the US it would be the Federal Reserve, which is,
yes,
a private institution,
yes,
the Federal Reserve will start to monetize the debt. In other words, they buy the government's debt directly,
yeah,
in effect printing money.
Yes.
It's a convoluted process which is designed to obscure what is actually going on.
They call it quantitative easing these days, but it's essentially,
yeah,
money printing.
Yes, it is money printing.
Yes.
But the money doesn't come free. It is borrowed off the central bank.
Yes.
So the American people, in order to pay their current bills, are putting up an increasing debt,
yes,
which will carry on and carry on. And in order to pay that back, they borrow more money from the central bank. And I believe, it's off the top of my head, but I believe of all the debt issuance at the moment, it is over 50% that is being bought by the Federal Reserve directly.
Yes.
And not by either private individuals. You can buy government debt.
Yes.
Or institutions.
I wouldn't if I were you.
No, not of them. Or institutions or countries. At the moment, it is the private central bank buying the government's debt and monetizing it, and that will not end well.
And what an extraordinary thing it is that so many of these central banks are private institutions. I'm glad to say that the Bank of England, which was founded as a private institution, eventually got nationalized and is no longer run purely for the benefit of a few shadowy shareholders. The U.S. Federal Reserve is, you know, the Volckers and the Greenspans and the Bernankes of this world. These are private people. They're not appointed by the federal government. These are private people running the currency of the United States into the ground for private profit.
In the case of the chairman, you know, Ben Bernanke at the moment, he is officially appointed by the president.
But marked in the same way as the Queen appoints ministers.
Yeah, it's
a rubber stamp.
Very much so.
Yes.
But it does give the illusion of state control of the institution. But in reality, it isn't. You look at it at face value and you think it is connected with the government. It's a sort of symbiotic relationship. But behind the real truth is that it is private and it is run for private interest, not in the interest of the people.
And we have a caller on the line, so let's have him on. Zach, you're welcome. Do say whatever you want to say.
Hello?
Hello, Zach.
Hi, Zach.
Hey. Yeah, like I was... basically, the main thing I was about to say is loans come before reserves in the bank system right now.
Well, the way it works is that there are no reserves, unfortunately. It's all loans. This is the extraordinary thing about national banking, that they can break all the rules which they impose on other banks. They do not have to have any longer reserves to match the various borrowings that they indulge in. So it's the whole thing is a complete fraud. I mean, the interesting thing, Zach, is that they call themselves the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. They call themselves the Bank of England. They call themselves the Bank of France. All these banks were originally, and the Federal Reserve for one still is, actually private institutions. And they are destroying the U.S. currency for private profit. The more you lose by having inflation on your money, the more they gain by it. And it is quite extraordinary that this has been allowed to go on for so many centuries now. And you may know that in the history of the United States, there have been many attempts by presidents, notably Jefferson and Jackson, to try very hard to stop this happening. And Jackson actually refused to sign a bill that was put up by Congress because they'd all been bought by the then U.S. bank. It wasn't called the Federal Reserve then. It was called the First or Second Bank of the United States. I forget which. But they tried to get their charter renewed early because they knew that while he was president, Congress might not renew it when they came to the end of his term and it was due for renewal. So they tried to put this bill through Congress, which they got through Congress. He then refused to sign it. And it's well worth your while to read the letter that he wrote to Congress, to the Senate, in fact, explaining why he refused to sign it. Because it's really revealing of just how much damage these institutions do to the body politic. And here was a politician at last, an incorrupt man, not subject to being bought by them, who just said, we are not having this, I'm not going to sign this bill. And it was a very, very brave stance that he took. And the real problem now is that we do not have politicians like him who really understand the issues or understand them in the way that Thomas Jefferson used to understand them and wrote about them. Benjamin Franklin was another who commented on this in his writings. James Madison was another. Many, many of your founding fathers and your earlier presidents have struggled with and confronted this hideosity of the way the banking system has kind of intruded itself into government in a manner which is frankly dishonest, so that most people who are ordinary electors do not realize that much of their government's financial system is being run by banks that are privately owned, and they're being run for profit at the expense of the general taxpayer and the general citizen.
And again, the problem with that, of course, is that the hand that gives is above the hand that takes. So the government is the hand that takes from the private central banks, which are giving the money. So they are in a position, as Lord Monckton said earlier, to dictate the terms.
And the banks are not elected by anyone.
Absolutely not.
And what we get here is a kind of institutionalized public corruption, for that is really what it is. And I'd like to move on very briefly to another form of institutionalized public corruption, which is President Obama's birth certificate. Now, he very foolishly, to my mind, put up on the White House website and personally endorsed a document which a 9-month investigation by Sheriff Joseph Arpaio of Phoenix, Arizona, has found to be not just probable cause forged, but very definitely a forged document. Now, I have talked to various congressmen and senators about this. I've written to them about it. I've said, look, I used to investigate frauds for Margaret Thatcher. Concerned citizens called me in to have a look at this one to see whether the sheriff was right. I went to see him. I looked at his evidence, such of it as he has made public. I wasn't shown anything that he hasn't made public. I must make that clear. And I, having gone through it and having talked to experts of my own, am quite sure that the sheriff is right on this. That document is bogus. I've used a mathematical technique that I sometimes use on this, and the chance of that document being genuine, because there are so many independent errors yes. in it, is 1 in 75 sextillion. It is definitely a forgery. And yet, here's the thing. The Republican Party, which seems to be dead from the neck up and dead from the neck down, will not raise this question as it should. But I promised earlier in the program I'd give you the latest news on this. There is a citizen of Hawaii called Duncan Sunahara, whose sister, Virginia, died on the 4th of August 1961 in Hawaii, the very day when Obama is said to have been born in Hawaii. And recently, Duncan Sunahara went to the Hawaiian authorities and he said, please can I have a copy of my dead sister's long form birth certificate? I want a certified copy of the original document. And the state of Hawaii has just filed a response to his appeal against the court's decision that he can't have the document that Hawaiian law says he can have. And this appeal has been rejected or hit back by the state of Hawaii by their saying to the court in a written document that I just literally, it became available today, that they reckon that what he is doing is asking for his sister's birth certificate because they want to see whether or not Mr. Obama's birth certificate has got the same number as this one. That it, in other words, they've realized that that's what this is about. At least they say they've realized that. And they're saying that because it's about that and not about the man wanting his sister's birth certificate for sentimental reasons, he shouldn't be allowed to have her birth certificate. So look at the lengths to which they're going. Pages and pages and pages of expensive legal argument, when it would have taken them 5 minutes to go down to the vault, make a copy of the thing, and just give it to him. And this, frankly, stinks. And yet the Republicans won't lift a finger. Even the independent Republican candidates, the likes of Gary Johnson, won't lift a finger. They will not say to the state of Hawaii, you've got to produce the original document and show it to forensic experts acting for the sheriff so we can put this matter to bed altogether. And again, it's an instance here of this public corruption. And civilizations, when they come to an end, they always come to an end in this way, where the people at the top are openly corrupt, visibly corrupt.
Little pretense.
They put up bogus documents on websites so everybody can see they're bogus. And yet, nobody lifts a finger to stop them. And that is what I find astonishing and really worrying about this development to do with the birth certificate. It ties in with the kind of artificiality of the way the central banks are now operating. It ties in with the fact that this global warming scam that we've been talking about earlier in this session is something which has been whipped up by the usual suspects as yet another way of enriching the governing class at the expense of the rest of us and putting all these matters beyond the reach of the electors.
And it's not control as well, not just the enriching, it's the control element that comes in.
It's enriching and empowering, and that's right. Yes, exactly. They are becoming more powerful at our expense. Yes. Now, here am I, a member of the governing class, and yet I can see this, and it worries me. Because civilization cannot long endure while those who govern it are not being open and honest with the people and are not directly accountable to the people by way of election. And, for instance, how should this matter of the birth certificate be dealt with? Several people have written to the head of the Secret Service in Washington and said, look, you have a particular job in the Secret Service to investigate the authenticity of identification documents. You also have a job to protect the president and, of course, in protecting him, protecting the institution of which he is the current incumbent. And therefore, it is for you particularly as the Secret Service to investigate this. Yep. As far as I know, not one of the people who have written to the Secret Service in that way has ever received anything more than an acknowledgement that the return receipt requested has been sent out. No substantive reply at all. The public authorities do not want to touch this one.
Yep.
Now, Sheriff Arpaio of Maricopa County in Phoenix, Arizona, he didn't want to touch it either. And he said to the 250 citizens who asked him to do this, he said, look, please will you go away? I haven't got time for this. It's really, I'm not quite sure it's within my jurisdiction. They said, look, it's a fraud. It's within your jurisdiction. It's a forgery. It's within your jurisdiction. Just look at it, mate. So he put it to his cold case posse, a team of unpaid volunteers, but experts in this kind of work. And he said, have a look at this and just tell me it's okay and I'll tell them to run along. And they couldn't do it. They said, we can't tell you that.
He gave him a problem he didn't want.
He didn't want this problem at all. And the next thing that happened was the Department of Justice was in there saying that this was going to be something that they want to investigate him for. They're now investigating him for something.
Giving him a hug.
Totally trumped up thing. And so what we're seeing here is the collapse of any sort of decency or honor or openness among the governing class. That's the significance of Al Gore going around talking up this global warming scare and profiting mightily to the hundreds of millions by doing so. You've got Obama profiting mightily by being in the White House when it may be, I don't know where he was born, to tell you the truth, but I do know that that document is bogus. So I'm no birther, but that document's not bogus. But he too, benefiting from the fact that somehow the governing class has become untouchable, when the whole idea of democracy is that people who commit these enormous scams on the general public should be held to account before the general public for those scams. And then you have this banking system. It's all part of the same picture of moral intellectual and now financial collapse. It's a great shame, but I want to end on a note of hope. We had a Marine who called in earlier. There are people in our armed forces who are still willing to go out and put themselves in harm's way and risk everything, including their own precious lives, for the sake of us. So we can be grateful always to them for everything that they have done to try to uphold the idea of nationhood and freedom and democracy and independence and prosperity, which was the birthright that your founding fathers bequeathed to you. That is what they wanted you to have. They wanted you to be free. They wanted you to be prosperous. They wanted you to be democratic. They wanted you to have a republic if you can keep it. And the question now is, can you keep it? While there are gentlemen like that Marine willing to stand and fight for the freedoms that you enjoy and through your freedoms for the freedoms that we hope one day we will enjoy, then America will still stand proud in the world and we will still have a world that's worth standing proud in. So thank you all very much for being with me over this last hour. It's been, last 2 hours, in fact, it's been an enormous privilege to have the chance to guest host this show and here with Charles. Charles, would you like to say goodbye very briefly and add any last few words?
Yes, just it's very nice to be on. And I think where America goes, the West goes. And it's up to you to stand up and ensure it goes in the right direction.
And once again, if you want to donate to the Alex Jones Show, then please get in touch via PayPal, which is very easy to do on the net, or via InfoWarsShop, all one word, .com, InfoWarsShop.com, or you can telephone your donation in at 1-888-253-3139. I'll give you that number again, 1-888-253-3139. Or you can write to InfoWars, P.O. Box 19549, Austin, Texas 78760. And we have a call, I think.
Gentlemen, Alex Jones here, driving into the office. Overslept a bit because I did about 24 hours in the last day and a half. And I just want to thank both of you for coming on during this 48-hour transmission. I want to thank everybody that's donated to help us get the satellite uplink equipment and also pay for the subscription to it. We're reaching tens of millions a week now conservatively, and we really intend on expanding that because people are hungry, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. We've got cable systems and TV stations all over the world that want to be able to get the nightly news show in real time so that when Lord Monckton and many others are on the show, they'll be able to not just get out to areas of the United States, or over my syndicated radio show, but to the entire world. And we don't have big globalist money funding us. We don't get any banker bailout money like MSNBC and George Soros get. And so it's just really great that people are helping us at InfoWarsMoneyBomb.com or InfoWarsShop.com. And I'll be in there in about 15 minutes to interview Joel Skousen on air about all the different geopolitical ramifications. But I just wanted to thank both of you gentlemen for doing the show and just to make some closing comments, and then I'll let you guys get on about your day and your business. But again, it's just great to be able to be driving through Austin and also listen to you on the local FM station. It's great to be able to confront these evil people because, as Thomas Jefferson said, all that evil men and tyrants need to flourish is that good men do nothing. And so we're going to give them a run for their money. And so I'm going to let you guys finish up, and we'll go to this Agenda 21 group of reports by our nightly news reporters, and then I'll be there in studio in about 5 minutes away. So, gentlemen, again, I'll let you have some final comments, and thank you for all your time, and God bless.
Well, Alex, thank you very much. It's been a great fun being on your show and acting as just another part of the voice of freedom. I like to tease Alex quite a lot when I'm on his show. I always say he is about as far out as you can go without quite falling over the edge. He's a great character. He's built up this really magnificent brand now, which is the brand of freedom. He's realized it is a fight. It is a war to make sure that they do not control information, that we are still allowed to retain free speech. We are allowed to question things like the global warming scare. We are allowed to think that perhaps there are better ways of banking than the Federal Reserve Bank that we're allowed to look at all these questions like, is our president really our president? Is he genuinely a man who was born in Hawaii? Or does he merely have a certificate saying that he was born somewhere else in the world to a Hawaiian citizen and therefore is a Hawaiian citizen by right of that process? All of these matters are matters which we are allowed to question on programs such as Alex Jones. Even on Fox News, you cannot cover many of the topics we've done today because they have taken preconceived positions along with the rest of the establishment that they don't want to take the risk of sounding lunatic by being called birthers or otherwise being diverted. One of the things the left does, it attacks viciously the likes of Alex Jones, the likes of me. It's already begun attacking the likes of you, Charles. You know what it's like being on the wrong end of this now. In order to frighten off anybody else from daring to stand up and say, just a moment, this is taking our freedom, our democracy, our prosperity away, and we're not having it. Well, we will continue for as long as the good Lord chooses to allow us to do, to speak up for freedom. So will Alex Jones. God bless you all, and thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you.
When the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. Thomas Jefferson. Global government despises Infowars.com. Donate now. Long live liberty. Death to the New World Order.
This is the Infowars Nightly News. I'm Aaron Dykes.
And I'm Melissa Melton. Agenda 21 is not a conspiracy theory. And while it may seem harmless or even helpful on the surface, it is a UN-inspired, banker-funded scheme to institute a global government from the ground up. Right here, right now, our country is being taken over in the name of sustainable development.
Local environmental groups are meeting in towns across America backed by big federal grant money. But behind that, entities like the Rockefeller Foundation, their sustainable community meetings are not only a takeover, but a buy-in to a planned society controlled by a psychopathic elite, all sold with a smile. So to find out more, we decided to investigate some of those local meetings taking place in Texas to find out about the dark deception behind this Agenda 21 scheme.
They had growth on them so quickly and so heavily, they didn't have time to plan.
What is sustainable development?
The conservation of energy resources.
People that live there maybe don't have to drive as much.
Concentrated and balanced growth.
Concentrated and balanced growth.
And the kind of growth you want to see.
To help you achieve the vision.
Higher density mixed-use development in the center of town.
How compact or not is it creating this much more interconnected grid?
Growth here is more balanced.
Housing and jobs balance with the stakeholder committee's participation in line with the Sustainable Places Project.
The Housing and Urban Development Department of the United States awarded Sustainable Communities Regional Planning grants to Texas, giving $3.7 million to the Capital Area Council of Governments in a project that spanned Austin, Texas, as well as neighboring rural communities that include Elgin, Lockhart, Hutto, and Dripping Springs. The grant specifies guidelines for energy use and climate change mitigation, as well as the integration of smart housing, nearby job sectors, and integrated transportation systems. The members of the project we spoke with in Elgin were apparently unaware of HUD's related agenda to the larger Agenda 21 program.
Agenda what?
Agenda 21.
What's the number stand for?
21st century.
And what does that mean?
Well, see, I'm not familiar with it at all, so I couldn't comment on that. So I'm not sure what their criteria or their outline is on that.
Respectfully, there is no national treaty that obligates local governments to follow Agenda 21. That just doesn't exist. That's a myth.
We're promoting sustainable, responsible development. Mm. But it's nothing to do with the United Nations. I mean, you know, if that's just paranoia, I'm sorry.
In fact, there is an international agenda at work, Austin is a model city for the ICLEI, the NGO partnered with the United Nations to push for local Agenda 21 implementation. In the name of sustainability, they've taken on some of the most ambitious carbon cuts in the entire nation and are a model for energy conservation and zero waste. And unelected regional boards are drawing the rest of Central Texas into this international scheme, all in the name of sustainability. Among other groups, Smart Growth America and the ICLEI Local Governments for Sustainability USA Group specifically congratulated the cities and towns receiving these HUD grants for sustainable communities and regional planning. So it is absurd to claim that there is no international agenda interacting with these local communities as they attempt to implement sustainable development goals.
Well, I know a lot about Agenda 21, and I don't have any concerns because I don't think this... I don't think this project is driven by the international community or even by the national community. I think it's driven by Elgin, Texas.
Except it's been implemented nationally under treaty and these grants are coming from the federal level. I think it's really dishonest not to admit there's an Agenda 21 motive.
Sustainability is just about letting local communities decide for themselves.
We had heard so much about what Agenda 21 wasn't, we decided to interview a professor that teaches it. This is Dean Almy, an associate professor and director of graduate programs in urban design and landscape architecture at the University of Texas.
Now, in Texas, Texas Triangle is one of the 10 identified mega regions of the United States. And the projections, which were pretty much just confirmed by the recent census data that was released, are that populations in the Texas Triangle will double in the next 20 to 30 years. And one of the big problems, of course, is that it starts to create new towns, new communities, but are they really communities? Are they really towns when they're all sort of evolving in a really short time?
He teaches Agenda 21 courses at the university.
So the course I teach, which I call Agenda 21, really deals with the question of sustainable urbanism. How do we begin to sort of build the city more sustainably moving forward?
What is Agenda 21, kind of a brief overview, and why you feel that it's an important plan?
Well, it was a resolution of the United Nations, where a number of countries got together, ostensibly in Rio, also called the Rio Declaration, to begin to look at the way in which humans were occupying the world, the state of the world, the state of civilization in the world, how we were using resources, whether the consumption of resources and global development was being achieved ecologically and equitably.
And when recently asked about the UN's plan by a San Antonio-based news station, he was quoted as saying, "It's changing the status quo of how we operate as a country that is developing, and so it's threatening to some people. Urban design by its nature is about the collective good and isn't necessarily about the freedom of any one person to do whatever the hell they want."
So I was going to ask you if you wanted to talk about that quote a little bit.
Well, I mean, already, you know, if we're looking for code words, okay, so already in that quote is the term collective, which, you know, a conspiracy theorist could somehow associate with, you know, I don't know, the Soviet Union. Right? And that's not
communism.
That's not the intent. You know, collective just means us together as a society. So I kind of stand behind that, actually. Cities are not individual constructs built by single people. Cities are collective constructs where we all live together, and we have to balance the needs of individuals and the needs of collective society. And cities, by their very nature, would be very difficult to construct and manage and develop if they were all sort of politically anarchic.
Agenda 21 Sustainable Development Visioning Meetings rely on the Delphi technique, a manipulation tactic wherein a facilitator ensures a public forum goes as planned with a predetermined outcome already decided upon by those who ultimately called the meeting. The Delphi technique was created by the Rand Corporation in the 1950s for the U.S. Department of Defense to use as a psychological weapon during the Cold War. While community feedback is encouraged, The final outcome is driven by leading questions and preset answers. These same exact strategies were outlined in detail in the local Agenda 21 handbook. We saw this at both sustainable development meetings we attended. No matter what answer a community member chose, it all fed into the Agenda 21 plan already underway. The project planners admitted they weren't working with a blank slate, but were instead following a plan already mapped out by so-called stakeholders.
What we want to be really clear about is that we're not starting from sort of an empty slate. Your community has done a lot of work in setting in place lots of plans and policies like the comprehensive plan.
We're planners. We've been involved in projects mostly in Central Austin and in, around that area. We worked on the Miller redevelopment for many years, and we're still working on it. The downtown Austin plan, we're working on several master plan communities around the region. A lot of focus on urban infill and redevelopment.
And have you ever heard of Agenda 21?
Yes, but just recently.
Is this a part of that plan?
No.
Is it affiliated in any way? No. The reason I ask is because you use a lot of the same terminology, visioning workshops and sustainable development, and a lot of that falls under that plan, and I just didn't know.
That is very traditional planning talk from the last probably 30 years. So we always talk about, you know, having a vision. What is the general big picture vision?
But there's a larger agenda going on. I mean, this is a regional development. It didn't start here in Elgin. These proposals didn't originate here in Elgin. They're being done in other cities.
I think these proposals did originate here in Elgin.
Why are all these plans springing up all at once at the same exact time, all over the country, all over every city, though? If it's not a coordinated effort.
Well, I don't want to be contentious with you. I would just say that I think that's a myth. They're not springing up all over the country. In this whole region, there's four cities looking at it.
In fact, these sustainable communities were popping up in nearly every major metro area across the country, all funded by HUD. And these sustainable communities are pursuing the international agenda under President Obama's Partnership for Sustainable Communities, joining together the policies and regulations of housing and urban development, the Department of Traffic, and the EPA.
I actually went to my first sustainable development meeting last week. They received a federal grant from Obama's Partnership for Sustainable Communities, and they seem to use a lot of the same language in Agenda 21. I didn't know if you knew about those sustainable meetings that have been happening around here and if those are somehow connected.
Well, there are a number of layers of sustainability, I mean, almost to the point where the term itself is sort of overused. But here at the School of Architecture, we have a Center for Sustainable Development, which does get grants from foundations, sometimes from federal government, usually from philanthropic foundations. And they are a clearinghouse for a whole series of different initiatives.
Texas has been faced with so-called smart growth proposals for well over a decade now. For years, bureaucrats in the Texas area laughed in the faces of activists, even as they gave passionate speeches defying the implementation of toll roads and other unnecessary infrastructure already owned by the state of Texas and its citizens. Instead, unelected regional boards like Campo moved the measures forward as best they could, while insiders who amounted to little more than thieves skimmed off the top and made millions off of secret deals. And yet we see some of the same regional players pushing for further development in the name of sustainability.
The Central Texas Vision for Growth was directed by CAPCOG, Trust for Public Land, and Envision Central Texas. These entities, in turn, are shaped and steered by countless environmental groups controlled and funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, George Soros, and Ted Turner, among others. Their alignment with Agenda 21 is well documented. Sustainable development was coined by the United Nations to mask a covert takeover at the local level. Land conservation and smart growth planning have been used to subsidize insiders, allowing development to be hijacked while the system picks winners and losers, reaping the profits at our expense.
Everything in green is the